This episode of Reading Women is brought to you by The House of Chanel.
For Gabrielle Chanel, reading was a refuge which allowed her to invent her own destiny right from childhood. Literature became a passion she shared with the love of her life, Boy Capel, and her friends like Cocteau Colette, Pierre Reverdy, and Max Jacob. She helped the authors she admired without them knowing. She had the story of her life told by Paul Morand, Louise de Villemorin, and Michel Dion. She read for inspiration and then became an inspiration herself. Watch the film Gabrielle Chanel and Literature at InsideChanel.com.
Hello, I'm Kendra Winchester, and this is Reading Women, a podcast inviting you to reclaim half the bookshelf by discussing books written by or about women. Today, I'm talking to Meredith McCarroll, one of the editors of Appalachian Reckoning, a region response to Hillbilly Elegy, which is out now from West Virginia University Press. For a full transcript of our conversation, check out the episode show notes or head over to readingwomenpodcast.com and make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss a single episode. So today we have a special bonus episode for you. I was thrilled to be able to talk to Meredith McCarroll, whose work I have appreciated and been a huge fan of, and so it was a delight to be able to talk to her today about all things Appalachia. Now, a couple years ago, Autumn and I interviewed Elizabeth Catt about her book, What You're Getting Wrong About Appalachia, in which she discusses all of the problematic things around J.D. Vance's memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. So I won't rehash all of those things that we talked about with Elizabeth Catt. I will link that episode down in the show notes. But this interview with Meredith is a thematic part two to that. So we've acknowledged that Hillbilly Elegy is problematic, but now what? And I really appreciated the positivity that Meredith brought to this conversation, which was very encouraging. We recorded this episode the day before the 2020 election, and I must admit, I was pretty anxious about what was going to happen and if there would be a repeat of the conversation about Appalachia that happened after the 2016 election. I didn't know what was going to happen with the release of the film version, Hillbilly Elegy, which was scheduled to go out in late November, and what that would look like. But I have never been happier to be so wrong in that there are so many incredible Appalachian writers and just media people from the region and also Appalachian people who live outside the region who reviewed this movie and are speaking up about how problematic the memoir and the movie are in our perspective of Appalachia. All of these chorus of voices, I think, continue this idea that Meredith McCarroll and Anthony Harkins were working on with Appalachian Reckoning, of presenting a chorus of voices from Appalachia to point out that no singular voice can speak for an entire region. And I really appreciated that. And I found this interview, this conversation with Meredith, incredibly thought-provoking on spending our energy being pro-Appalachia instead of anti-J.D. Vance. And I think that was very encouraging as we move forward from this point of discussions around Hillbilly Elegy and moving forward to supporting the region in the various ways that we can. So what I'm going to do is link a bunch of resources in the show notes, including other podcasts that focus on Appalachia, like Black in Appalachia, as well as Appodlachia, and you can go check those out. They're pretty fabulous, I must say. And also, I will link our interviews with Appalachian women from around the region down in the show notes as well, so you can go check those out. And recently, I actually started a Read Appalachia Bookstagram, and I will admit, I've spent way too many nights not being able to sleep and scrolling through the internet trying to find more Appalachian media and different things, and I was on Bookstagram, and I thought, hey, I cannot find a Appalachian focused Bookstagram anywhere. Why don't I start one? And so I have. So if you're interested in getting most, you know, up-to-date reading on different things that I've been doing with Appalachian literature and writing, definitely go check that out. All of these resources will be linked in the show notes. And also Meredith McCarroll gives some in her discussion throughout the interview. And so I will link those as well. All right. So I just want to say thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy this conversation that I had with the wonderful Meredith McCarroll. Welcome to the podcast, Meredith. I am so excited to finally be able to have you on the show.
I am so excited to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, as many of the listeners know already, I am from Appalachia, and so I made a little game plan for myself when I heard that a certain movie was going to be coming out. And so we are going to be talking today about your work and your writing, but also Appalachian Reckoning, which the subtitle is A Region Response to Hillbilly Elegy, which I feel definitely just describes, you know, how we feel about it.
Yeah.
But first, I want to talk about you and the work that you do. So for our listeners who may not be as familiar with the things that you write about, would you just be able to describe it for them?
Sure, I'll do my best. So I have a background in working on representations of whiteness in African-American literature and film, but I was born and raised in Appalachia, and always thought that that wasn't really a very interesting thing to write about, because I thought I was more, you know, I was like, well, I'm really interested in thinking about power and race and representation, and so I could never possibly write about Appalachia. And so it really wasn't until I finished my PhD in African American literature and film and had this way of thinking about text, this critical whiteness studies approach to thinking about text, that I turned that approach to looking at regional studies and looking at representations of Appalachia. And we can talk more about how this happened, but it definitely was kind of personal. It was about my own experiences of making my way through the world as an academic and seeing the ways that I had been stereotyped, and I didn't even realize that I was being stereotyped. So my first book is called Unwhite, Appalachia, Race, and Film. And in that book, I take a critical race theory approach to looking at the types of figures that exist in representations of Appalachia in Hollywood cinema primarily. And so I'm definitely influenced by people who've come before me, both within Appalachian studies, like Jerry Williamson, who has written about the portrayals of Appalachian people in movies. But I was also really influenced by people like Donald Bogle, who writes about different types of characters in African, different representations of African Americans. And so he writes about how, if you look at, you know, 100 years of African American film, so many of those films, like the different characters fall into a few different types. And so I took that approach to look at Appalachian films, to think about what types emerge in Appalachian cinema, and and make the argument that is a little complicated about how all of the people in Appalachian movies are, well, I say all of them, almost all of them are shown as phenotypically white, but they're also in this position as outsiders. And so I use this term unwhite to think about how race and power are functioning in movies and the ways that representations of place really matter. So that's my first book. And then I was really working on a collection of essays about voice and accent. I had written a piece about my own accent and the ways that I kind of learned to hide my accent once I was in college and then in graduate school. And so I'd written an essay there, and I was doing a collection of essays with other people on voice and Appalachia. And that merged with this project that Tony Harkins was doing that was directly addressing Hillbilly Elegy. And so what came together were these kind of two halves of a book that, when they came together, I think became something, I think it's a little bit magical what happened in that collection, but that became Appalachian Reckoning, A Region Response to Hillbilly Elegy, which I co-edited.
And that recently won, I believe, is it an American Book Award?
It did win an American Book Award. Yes. Very exciting.
So congratulations. I was very excited to see that, having spent last year slowly reading and annotating it. And just being able to see the region respond and it to be recognized in that way. But you mentioned writing a piece about your own accent. So you're from Appalachia. Where in Appalachia are you from?
So I'm from Western North Carolina, so the mountainous part of North Carolina, which is in the southern Appalachians, so the southern United States. I'm from near Asheville, North Carolina.
So I went to the mountains of North Carolina this summer, and so it was great to see a different part of Appalachia than from where I'm from, which is Appalachian, Ohio, and northern Kentucky. Yeah, it's always lovely to learn more about the different kinds of Appalachian culture out there. And that's something that I really appreciated about Appalachian Reckoning is the way that so many different kinds of people had the opportunity to contribute to this collection, to give a really huge range of perspectives, which I think goes to the idea that no single perspective can be a voice for a region.
Yeah, you just said so much there that is really important to us. So it's so amazing to create something and then to hear what you really hoped would get across, to hear that echoed back. So that was amazing to hear you talk about that just now, because, you know, when you talk about the area where you were raised, we were raised in really different kinds of places, I bet. And so I think that that's part of what is so important, but also so tricky in talking about Appalachia, is that I don't know if it's human nature or what, but I think that there's a tendency to just kind of want to draw boundaries and define places and people and belief systems and all of this stuff. And you can maybe do that in a more micro way, but you certainly cannot define Appalachia. You know, I'm sure that we had some shared experiences, but yeah, I mean, Appalachian Ohio and Western North Carolina look really different. They probably feel really different. They have different economic systems in some ways. They have different, you know, there's so much that's different there. And when you're talking about a 13-state region, it's a little bit crazy to imagine that anybody is going to try to speak for that region. And that's why I think it's so important to have a collective of voices rather than one person claiming to speak for the region.
So a couple years ago, we had Elizabeth Catt on, and she talked about What You're Getting Wrong About Appalachia and described, I mean, she wrote a whole book on it, so describing a summary is, I imagine, difficult, but she described the basics of why hillbilly elegy is harmful because it leans into so many different stereotypes, and I'm thinking about the entire book at this point, and I'm like, how can you, you can't even summarize it, Kendra.
No. Well, that book by Elizabeth Catt is so brilliant because, you know, I mean, it's such a great title because it's really clear what she's doing, but she is so, so smart, and she's looking at it in so many intricate, complex ways that just are mind-blowing, even for people who are from the region or have studied the region. I think everyone learns something from that book because she's just such a student of history and looks at it from so many different ways and is able to take apart all of the things that are going on in Vance's book that simplify something that is very complicated.
Yeah. And I really loved her piece in Appalachian Reckoning as well. She's actually the person that recommended it to me because she said, hey, you know, I'm working on this thing for this, you know, collection of essays. And so I really love being able to see her perspective, but also the perspective of a wide range of people. For you, what is the thing that you saw coming up again and again with people's dissent against hillbilly elegy?
Yeah. Well, I'm a scholar of narrative. I'm a scholar of literature and film. And so what I was most paying attention to, I mean, there were so many people writing from so many different perspectives, you know, looking really from looking at voting, looking at politics, looking at labor rights. I mean, there were so many different ways that people were looking back at Hillbilly Elegy and challenging it. What I was most interested in was the narrative perspective, I think. So, and I think that that's what I tended to notice that so many people were focusing on as well. So I felt like, so Hillbilly Elegy came out in the summer of 2016, and, you know, it was talked about as this memoir, and I think a lot of people from the region read it, and I know that a lot of people from within the region, you know, they there were parts of it that were familiar to them, whether they're, you know, they had a mamaw or a meemaw or a granny that was similar to the figure that's so crucial to J.D. Vance in that book, or they had an uncle that was, you know, similar, that they had been around poverty and drug abuse. And, you know, there were parts of it that I know really felt familiar to people. And that, to me, I think is part of the beauty of memoir, is that you can tell your own story and there are moments that will resonate with other people, even if their stories are very different than yours. And so the memoir part of the book is not the thing I have an issue with. I don't think it's a particularly well-written memoir. And I think if it were just a memoir, then it would definitely not have gotten the attention that it got. So I think that if he had stuck to writing memoir, then that would have been one thing. But what he does, and what drew so much critique from people that I was noticing, is that he shifts from first person singular to first person plural. So it ceases to become a memoir when he starts writing about we. It's fine for him to say, I experienced this, I was a victim, and I worked really hard and got myself out of it. That's a story he can choose to tell. But when he begins to say, we don't need help, we got ourselves into this mess and we'll get ourselves out, which is something that he explicitly says, that's what really bothered a lot of readers. I think that they felt like he was trying to speak on behalf of the region at that point. And so it was partly just the audacity of that move, but I think also the ends to which he was making that move bothered a lot of people. It was really evident to a lot of readers that he is doing something in terms of, well, he's making a political move in that shift from I to we and what he says from that we perspective. So that was the thing that I really noticed and paid a lot of attention to, was how you can't write a memoir of a region. It's not a genre. You can write a memoir about your own experience. You could maybe try to write a memoir of your family, and boy, that sounds dangerous, because you're inviting, the more people that you're trying to speak for, the more people, you're potentially going to misrepresent. And so for him to take on a memoir of a region, it's just was bold and invited a lot of critique.
And, you know, we're recording this the day before the presidential election. And it, you know, during the whole campaigning of this summer and into the fall, I keep thinking about 2016 when this came out, because I remember picking it up and reading it before the election. But after the election, a lot of people, both, you know, people who were both politically conservative and people who were politically liberal, both found something that they liked in Hillbilly Elegy. And I saw this all over, you know, media and the news, etc. And then preceded a lot of parachute journalism. So can you describe what it was like to watch that process, to have this book come out, and then after the election see it as held up as an example of why what happened did?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I mentioned that my background is in looking at African American literature and film, and therefore I've studied and thought a lot about African American culture, especially in the 20th century. And what happened with this book and the way that it solved a problem for people and answered a question for people reminded me very much of what happened with the Moynihan Report, which is like blaming, in that case, blaming African Americans for their own poverty. And in this case, I think Vance is blaming Appalachians for their own poverty, for, as he says, for getting themselves in the situation that they've gotten themselves into. And it's so weird for me to say Appalachians. That's not a phrase that I use, because I don't know what an Appalachian is. I know people who live in different parts of Appalachia and identify as like being from Southern Appalachia, or, you know, I mean, it's not a voting block. And so the way that it was treated as a voting block, and that he was called in as this savvy person who was happy to position himself and talk about it as a voting block and to explain the way that hillbillies are, was really infuriating. As I'm someone who deeply identifies as being from the Appalachian Mountains, and that is my cultural identity, and I am, you know, a really liberal college professor, and he's talking about all, you know, and I can think of dozens of people from the region, just from my small town, who are doing all kinds of different things, you know, who are fundraisers and doctors and you know, whatever, doing all these different things, and he's talking about voters in Appalachia as if they are all really stubborn Scots Irish fighting coal miners who are more, you know, who love family, but they're broken in these certain ways. Just like the way that he was talking about Appalachia was infuriating, both because it was a crazy thing to be talking about a region as huge and diverse as Appalachia as one thing, but also just seeing the way that he was blaming people in poor parts of Appalachia, in coal mining towns, or in towns where the industries have left, the ways that he was blaming those people for their own poverty. And it... And I guess the other thing is that you mentioned this kind of parachute journalism that has happened time and time again in the region, where people, you know, drop in and generally capture the story that they already knew they were going to capture. So they come in with a predetermined outcome and, you know, get some interviews, tell a story, and then they take off. And the way that he just so enabled that by scapegoating Appalachia. And I think that, you know, great writers have and great thinkers have come after that fall of 2016 and have looked at data in more complicated ways and have debunked the idea that it was, you know, of who voted for Trump, and have looked at, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates has this great piece in The Atlantic called The First White President, where he says it's white people across class lines who voted for Trump. So it's the people, you know, the women in Long Island, as well as the men in West Virginia or whatever that voted for Trump. And so when you start to see that, you realize that a certain story was being told for a certain reason. And I think that reason was blaming poor whites as if they were uneducated, and that's why they made this choice.
I remember seeing those pieces, and I married a Californian, and he's a suburbia boy from, you know, outside San Francisco. So we come from almost completely different worlds, which is always exciting. And so we ended up starting this whole group family discussion, and I was kind of like, you know, they're giving resources for other kinds of things. And I remember getting into an argument with a extended family member about I think Nancy Eisenberg did a review of Hillbilly Elegy or something in the New York Review of Books or something. And I was like, no, that other book mentioned, you need to read that one.
Yeah.
And just having this whole conversation. And the guy ended up saying something along the lines of, well, if these people are holding on to whatever values these are, why are they choosing to be poor? And I was like, we had this whole conversation and you obviously already knew what you were going to think at the end of this. Like, why did I kind of waste my time? And so to me, it felt like the journalists were having those kinds of conversations with their pieces of just saying, this is what we thought, here is the scapegoat that we have chosen, and this is the piece we're going to write. It was just agony just watching and like feeling like if you said anything, you were like shouting into a void.
Yeah, I think it was a really frustrating time to see those same stories be told over and over. But what's so important to remember is that what emerged from all different areas was, you know, really this, I guess, grassroots kind of response. People started debunking this from so many different perspectives. So one of the first people that I read was Dwight Billings, who has a piece in our book. And another one was by Bob Hutton, who has a piece in our book. People just, you know, publishing things on blogs and, you know, kind of random places across the internet that showed that there was this kind of groundswell of, I guess, just a movement of to complicate this narrative. And the way that it happened to me is so inspiring. And it was, his voice was challenged by so many other voices saying, no, that's not my experience. This isn't right. This isn't, you know, here's what you're getting wrong about Appalachia, as Elizabeth Catt framed it. And so the fact that all of these voices emerged to complicate Vance's, and, you know, some of them were furious and some of them were, you know, just driven more by logos, in fact, and wanting to correct what he was getting wrong. And that has happened. It makes me think about a moment in the early 1970s when Apple Shop was formed, which is an organization that empowers Appalachian folks to tell their own stories and to make films and to do all of this creative work and storytelling and collecting stories. And that came about after another moment of this parachute journalism that happened when Johnson launched the war on poverty from Appalachia. And, you know, there were these certain images that newscasters wanted to show, and they came into literally the same towns and captured the same houses and the same roads and told the same story, like you were saying, that it was kind of predetermined. And there was a response that was a natural response that happened in 1970 and that I think happened after the success of Hillbilly Elegy, if you're paying attention, it really corrected that one voice, and that happened really naturally, or I guess organically is what I meant. What I mean is that it emerged from all of these different areas, all of these different writers and these activists coming together to say, no, that's not the only story to be told from this region.
And that's something that I really appreciated, because a year before Hillbilly Elegy came out, I didn't even really consider myself Appalachian. I moved to the South. I moved to the upstate of South Carolina for college, and I had a really intense amount of culture shock. It was very open, the landscape in my mind. And, you know, you go through that process as a college student. But reading Vance's book and seeing parts of it I identified with, as in feeling like you don't fit in, feeling like there's something culturally that you're missing, like you're speaking a different language, those things I saw in it. But then as you keep reading, there's obviously so many other problems with it. So when I saw voices speaking up, I started reading their books and really digging into this part of my heritage and understanding that. And I think that, like you were saying, that's a huge, my journey is a huge journey that many of us in my generation have had through this whole conversation about Appalachia and hillbilly elegy.
Yeah, I think so. I think like finding a way to claim that part of your identity is really important. And it's hard to do when other people are defining what Appalachia means. It makes it less, it makes it too simplistic, and it also makes it less appealing. I think that there are a lot of reasons that people flee not only the geographic region, but flee the identity when, if you don't have a counter voice there to complicate this one pretty negative voice, or the really, I think, damaging images of representation of the region that you see in TV and film.
So we are now 4 years removed from when the book came out, and now the movie is coming out in a few weeks here, mm-hmm. also tied up again with another election. What are some things that you are concerned about with the release of the movie at this particular time in history? Is there anything that you are just keeping an eye out for as you watch the dialogue around this movie kind of and the story come up again?
You know, the thing I actually am concerned about is making sure that we don't focus so much on J.D. Vance that we miss bigger things happening around us. So that might seem funny because I definitely have, you know, I've gone on record. I'm on record right now as like challenging the way in which he wrote, particularly the we part of his book. But one of the things that I see that is entertaining, but also a little worrisome to me, is how angry people are at him and how angry people are at Ron Howard for making this movie, and that it's such an expensive film and so much money could be spent in different ways. And those, I think, are legitimate questions. It's thinking about systems and structures that support a film that is probably going to be rather stereotypical and narrow in its focus. But I think that if we get distracted by kind of pitching a fit about this movie or about J.D. Vance, I think we might miss a lot of other things that are happening around us. So the movie has been made. I think probably it will not do the damage that the book did in a certain way. And what I mean by that is, you know, every once in a while there's a movie that's set in the mountains and it relies on the same types and it reinforces those images, and it does damage. I believe that it does damage to see, you know, screaming women in these kind of ridiculous accents and a heroic boy who gets to leave because of his own hard work. I think that that does some damage in the world. But I think that what does more damage are, you know, systems and structures of oppression that rely on keeping people in their places and rely on, it's the structures that use those stereotypes to continue to do mountaintop removal or to justify destruction of places and extractive industries. That's who's actually, that's who we need to be paying attention to. I think that this is one cog in that machine, but I don't think that this is the machine. I think it's misguided angst to place all of that on J.D. Vance or on Ron Howard or on this movie, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's like they are just symptoms of a much bigger problem. So instead of focusing on these symptoms and spending our energy there, we should spend our energy on trying to address the bigger problems at play.
Yeah, definitely. And I think about if you read the book, Appalachian Reckoning, then you understand that we have what I think is powerful about the book is that there are so many different voices, and some of them are angry, but many of them are not angry. And the majority of the narratives that are in the book, whether they're poetry or memoir, they're stories that aren't even directly addressing hillbilly elegy. They're just other stories from the region. And their mere presence kind of drown out the power of one voice, or at least it creates, I guess the language we use in the introduction of the book is it creates a chorus rather than having one person who's stepping up to the mic over and over. But when we were working on this collection, Tony Harkins and I were really worried about making a book that was antagonistic. That was not our goal. And Roger May, who is a brilliant photographer and directs the project looking at Appalachia, which is a photography collective that he started several years ago, when we asked him to be involved in this project to bring on some of the photographs from Looking at Appalachia, we had a good hard phone conversation where he said, "I don't want to be part of anything that's mean-spirited." And that was exactly the language that Tony and I needed at that moment. And we could easily confirm, no, that's not what this project is about. This isn't an anti J.D. Vance book. This is a pro Appalachia book. And there's space for J.D. Vance to tell his story, but there's got to be space for all of these other people to tell their stories as well. And that's what I think worries me about the focus on one person, is that it's a distraction from what's going on, maybe what he's a part of, maybe what he's empowering, but we're missing what's actually doing the damage if we're just focusing on one small part of that.
I really like that when you said it is not an anti-J.D. Vance book, but it's a pro-Appalachia book, which we often talk about centering something and what the power in that mm-hmm. has. And I think that really centers Appalachia instead of centering Vance.
Yeah, it's true. We struggled with the title of this book because the title is Appalachian Reckoning and the subtitle is A Region Responds to Hillbilly Elegy, as you mentioned earlier. And it was important that we have the hillbilly elegy in there because we knew that that would help people understand what the book was about and what had given really what was the catalyst for the book. That was an important part, but we really were having such a hard time. Some of the titles that we had were more antagonistic or centered Vance and centered hillbilly elegy too much. And the book itself as an entire collection, I think, really works to decenter Vance and to center, I don't know what the center would be. I guess the center ends up being Appalachia, but there is no center, and that's kind of the point. There's a real complicated, I hope that there's a complicated image of the region that when you finish reading this, you don't feel like you've figured out Appalachia. You just know that you haven't figured out Appalachia, maybe.
Yeah, it's like a starting place is often what I call it when I pitch it to people. Mm-hmm. Because you include so many great artists and writers and who do a wide range of things. And that way an anthology can introduce you to their work and then you can go off and look at what projects they're involved in. I found so many great resources just by reading more work by the contributors in the book, which is a really fabulous benefit.
Yeah, definitely. And we were so lucky to have just incredible people. I mean, every piece, every photograph, every poem that's in there just adds so much. And we're drawing from a really deep well. We were really lucky to have such incredible contributors.
All right, so we've talked about all sorts of books today, but is there something that has come out maybe more recently, a book that you would like to recommend to our listeners that's about maybe anything, really anything you like, film, Appalachia, just something you've been enjoying reading over the last few months.
Absolutely. I have been really excited to read so many new things that have come out of the region. So one book that I would recommend is called Even As We Breathe, which is by Annette Sanyuk Clapsaddle. And it's her first novel. It is set in Western North Carolina and is, I won't say too much about it, but it tells the perspective, it's from the perspective of a young Cherokee boy who's working in Asheville. And she is a member of the Eastern Band Cherokee, and it's a fantastic novel that I would recommend. I would also recommend anything by David Joy, who is a novelist who has three books out now. And his most recent book is called When These Mountains Burn. And this is a book that is really situated. It happens to be really situated in place. And that's part of why I love it. But it actually, I think, could take place in a lot of different towns, a lot of different, I don't know if it could take place in another region, actually. I think it is particularly Appalachian in certain ways. But it's really a beautiful, fraught story of contemporary opioid crisis in Appalachia. And it's told from several different perspectives, and it's beautifully written. Let's see, what else? A short story collection that I love that just came out. I'm realizing I'm not sure how to say it on the radio or on the podcast. So Leia Hampton's short story collection, F Face, is great. And all three of these books, I'm so happy to say three books that came out this year. So those are some things that I've read recently that I have really loved.
And they're all from North Carolina, is that right?
They are.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are all from, actually really close to where I'm from. They're all from Western North Carolina, or living in Western North Carolina currently.
It's funny because everyone has been telling me to read David Joy's latest book, and so I ended up getting a copy. And so I was like, yes, I will read this, because everyone I talk to from Appalachia is telling me to go pick it up. So I will listen.
I think that he is a really important voice, in part because of the way it's kind of a strange description, but I don't know anyone who listens as well as David Joy. And that makes him, I think, an incredible writer, because he pays deep attention and he really takes things in, both as a friend and a human, but also as a writer. I think he's just collecting and really, he just cares really deeply, and that comes across in his work.
Yeah, I'm excited. Anyway, well, thank you so much for recommending those books, and I'll be sure to link them in the show notes. Thank you so much, Meredith, for coming on the show and talking to me about your work. I greatly appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a joy.
So I'd like to say a huge thank you to Meredith McCarroll for talking with me about the anthology Appalachian Reckoning, which is out now from West Virginia University Press and will of course be linked in our show notes. So I will include links to Meredith McCarroll's website and social media in the show notes, so you can definitely go check those out and get updates on the work that she is doing. I'd also like to say a special thank you to our patrons, whose support makes bonus episodes like this very much possible. You can find Reading Women at readingwomenpodcast.com and on Instagram at @TheReadingWomen. You can find me on social media at K as in kite, D as in Dylan, Winchester. Thanks so much for listening.